Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Jane Austen is big, very big. I thought I discovered her 30 years ago when I reread her novel, Emma, and the light bulb finally clicked on for me. But biographer Claire Harmon says that the history of Austen's fame is one of changing public tastes. In other words, there may come a day when her current allure will fade. I can't imagine that, but for now, she's big. And Claire Harmon is with us today, calling from England to talk about why. Thanks for joining us, Claire.
Hello.
The audience for Jane Austen is probably the most remarkable thing about her. It spans, you know, all socioeconomic levels, all different kinds of people. I think I mentioned that B.B. King was a big fan to somebody last night and their jaw dropped. I was wondering, what is it about Jane that appeals to so many different kinds of people?
Yeah, it's just amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
B.B. King. And also, somebody told me that William S. Burroughs was a big Jane Austen
yeah.
fan. And I was not able to corroborate that. I mean, it's so upsetting because I really wanted to put that in my book. But, you know, the idea that the author of The Naked Lunch would be going back and reading Emma or, you know, Pride and Prejudice was just so amazing. But, yeah, as you say, there's an astonishing width of her readership. And it's global. It's, you know, dozens of languages and covers almost every age range, both genders and... Yes, and it gets bigger and bigger. I mean, it seems to me that Austen's readership just expands, you know, all the time. Really, now through the films and the other media, but the basic unit that she's, you know, of her books and of the films and of all the adaptations is such an attractive one. I mean, it has this universal appeal because it's a very simple story, really. I mean, it's a love story. She deals in love stories, and she deals in gender conflict, and in a very funny way. So, you know, that's going to cover a lot of readers.
Probably her least popular period was when she was still alive. Mm-hmm. It's not unusual for lots of artists to be like that, and a lot of it was because her books weren't published immediately. They sat for a long time.
Yes, I think that's an absolutely extraordinary story, and it's not one that most biographers dwell on, because obviously with Austen being a vast phenomenon now, it's hard to imagine a time when she wasn't, you know, universally read and admired. But she really actually wasn't published until she was, you know, within 6 years of her death. I mean, mm-hmm. she was only published in her 30s, and she'd been writing for about 20 years at that point. So she's a very heartening example for any, you know, want to be writer, just to keep at it. Austen had at least three manuscript novels sitting about on the shelf by the turn of the 19th century, you know, 1801, 1802. She had early versions of Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, and Northanger Abbey just, you know, sitting there. And and when you think of these, of how beloved these books are now and how mm-hmm. well known they are, the idea of them being written and then nobody wanting them for years is quite mind-boggling. So yes, she just had her family, you know, her immediate circle as readers, and they loved her works, and they, you know, read and reread them and kind of lived in the joke and in the excitement of those books. And then eventually she did get published and had a nice backlog of donking novels. You know, so obviously when Thomas Edgerton bought her first book to be published, which was Sense and Sensibility, you know, she said, I got plenty more where that came from. and then, you know, during the next 6 years, she had four books published, and then there were the two that were published posthumously that were just about finished at her death.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Claire Harmon. She is author of Jane's Fame, How Jane Austen Conquered the World. Claire, what is it about the rereadability of Jane Austen? I you know, when I tell people how many times I've read her books, and I'm not unusual and probably on the low side compared to, you know, hardcore, super hardcore. I mean, you know, it's the hardcore thing is really hard to grasp too. How deep does it go? Why is she so rereadable?
I do know. But yes, you're quite right that some people just read her over and over and over again. I read her a lot, but I'm not a natural rereader of novels, even ones that I adore. You know, I like to remember rather than reread. But and as you were saying earlier, when one reads these books as a young person, I mean, I read Austen as a teenager and didn't really get it. You know, I thought, well, somebody told me they were funny, and I thought, well, what's funny about this?
Right.
But as you get older, I mean, Austen goes with you in every phase of life. So, you know, you can read her at school when you're doing English literature exams, and then and be perhaps slightly puzzled, read her again as a, you know, a young adult, and you just every rereading brings out more of the texture. So you have the familiar part when you reread, which is delightful, and you know the story, but you also are kept in suspense by the story because she's so skilled at controlling you.
Uh-huh.
She's just a brilliantly controlling writer. So you're happy because you know it's going to be a happy ending. You're disturbed because you don't, you know, because she disturbs you in the meantime all the time. She just keeps mixing it up. And you're also, you know, you're delighted by the language and the jokes, and there's just always something. But then there's these little tiny edges come in, don't they? Every time you reread a book,
yeah.
When I was rereading Sense and Sensibility last year, after, you know, I'd finished my own book, there's always another little tiny nudge. You know,
a quote, something someone says.
Yes, exactly. Some embittered peripheral female character will just say something and come out of the texture for a moment and kind of give you a flash, you know, and then you think, oh my goodness, I know just what that situation's like. We have family parties where that kind of thing happens, or, you know, I've got neighbours who behave like this. And there's just a new little nuance every time, because everything's working in her books. I mean, there aren't flabby bits, there aren't purple passages, there aren't, you know, descriptions of rolling countryside. She just goes straight for the behaviour, and it's all one thing after another about people's interaction and behaviour and speech, and that's endlessly interesting. I mean, she's also a very intellectual woman, writing highly entertaining books, and it really makes a difference.
She doesn't use contrivances, adventure per se. It's everything everybody does has a motivation. There's a domino effect.
Yes.
And
yes.
It's really clear what's happening. But in her day, a lot of it was, you know, boats going over waterfalls and, you know, duels and, you know, catastrophe and pirate ships and, you know, damsels in distress.
Yeah,
how was she able intellectually to escape that? Because it was very popular. She probably could have made a lot more money quickly.
Yes, she could have made a lot more money, because one of her, you know, highly admired authors that she loved to read, Fanny Burney, was in 1814 published an appallingly kind of convoluted novel, which earned an enormous amount of money. I mean, it got a massive advance from Longmans, £3,000. And this was at a date when somebody like Austen was getting Mansfield Park published the same year, about, £200 or £150 if she was lucky. So, yes, there was a lot of money in Gothic and post-Gothic novels that, you know, were full, as you say, of ridiculous events and, you know, evil characters and victimized characters, and just, you know, the more extreme the behavior and the more outlandish the event. But Austen, yes, she loved those books. I mean, she just thought she was a very appreciative reader, and she loved rollicking Goodreads, and she loved absurd overwritten books. But she was such an ironist. I mean, she wasn't going to be able to write anything like that. She didn't want to write anything like that. She wanted to show her enjoyment of all sorts of reading by making reading much more, intellectual, really. I mean, because it's ironized and it's such a profound satire that it's terribly simple. I mean, she doesn't need to go for all that fireworks stuff.
You know, a lot of times folks are trying to figure out what character she is in the books, or how she represents her own personal point of view in the books. And typically she's associated with the female characters. But I often think of her voice coming out through a lot of the male characters, particularly the father in Pride and Prejudice.
Yes, yes. I think you're right. That dryness, that, clearly she had to be able, I mean, in order to be able to write that character, she had to sympathize with his point of view to quite an extent. And he is very droll. He is very observing and controlling, like an author is. In fact, he's much more like an author than a father, isn't he?
Well, when he says that his nephew or whatever is going to come, he goes, "No, I enjoy watching him make a fool of himself. This is I'm looking forward to this."
Exactly, it's a sort of it's a hands off, but it's a profoundly satirical point of view, isn't it? That Mr. Bennett has.
Yeah.
In fact, people criticize him for being cold and strange, you know, the fact that he's in that marriage and doesn't do much about it, doesn't do much about anything. But yes, I think you're right to see a lot of the author's own pleasure in observing and setting actions off there.
You know, the fact that her books did sit for so many years before being published, how did that affect, you wrote about how that affected her writing of subsequent books, that she was given, not having them published right away gave her sort of a freedom as a writer.
Yes, I think it's really pertinent. I think it gave her a freedom on one hand because, you know, if you're an unpublished writer, at least you don't have to account for your works. You can just perfect them. You can just write them for yourself. But also it did make her, she wanted to be published. It wasn't that she had some sort of strange, you know, desire just to remain in obscurity and be a posthumous writer at all. I mean, she certainly wanted to share her works. But the fact that she could always go back to them and change them, I think, made them very, very polished, very finished. And I'm personally convinced that she probably took out the topical references that may have been in them earlier on. The largest piece of an unfinished novel that remains is Sanderton, that she was writing right up to her death in 1817. And there are about 17,000 words of that novel. And it's full of topical references, things about 1816, 1817, around that time, very unlike Austen's other works. It's a kind of contemporary novel, but I think that it's got those references because she never finished it. I think the books that she finished, she combed out those things that would pin them down to any particular time, because she'd had these books sitting on the shelf since the early 1790s, some of them, and she didn't want to look like an old-fashioned, you know, writer who just was recycling some stale manuscripts. She wanted to make them timeless books, really. I mean, obviously they're of her period, but they're not burdened with any sort of over topical references.
Well, I think she kind of hit the mark.
Absolutely, that's why I think that's really. I mean, this is just it occurred to me when I was writing the book that sort of detachment from, you know, people have criticized Austen endlessly for not going on about the Napoleonic Wars, which she lived through, and the Industrial Revolution, and all the, you know, the big high politics of that period. I mean, that incredibly, you know, strenuous, difficult period in British history, certainly. It's not, I mean, you know, some critics who've wished to criticize Austen have said that it shows that she, you know, she just wasn't interested in her times, and she's irrelevant and she's small scale. But I think it shows quite the opposite, you know, that she was actually much more concerned with making her oeuvre readable to a lot of people. And it's really worked. I mean, because they're not just about sort of Catholic emancipation or the poor laws, they can be for any time. I mean, they're not just of the Regency period. They are, for, you know, they can be reread and reapplied in any period. And it had a major effect on her movability around the world and into different people's cultures and circumstances.
We have to take a short break. My guest is Claire Harmon, author and biographer, author of this just came out in March in the United States, Jane's Fame, How Jane Austen Conquered the World. We'll be right back. If you have questions or comments, give us a call, 614 614- 972-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'd love to know what your favorite Jane Austen novel is. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News, and you're a continuous listener to WOSU, so be a continuous supporter by becoming a sustaining member today. As a sustaining member, your gift automatically renews, saving you and WOSU time and money. Give $20, $50, or $100 a month, and your sustaining membership will also help to keep on-air fundraising to a minimum. To become a sustaining member, call 1-866-897-9678 or go online to wosu.org/sustainer.
Support for WOSU comes from Kappa, presenting the Four Bitchin' Babes with their current show, Divination, where music, laughter, and girlfriends reign. They'll bring their girl group harmonies and social commentary to the Southern Theater Sunday, May 23rd. More at kappa.com.
57 degrees in downtown Columbus with some light rain. Cloudy skies today, a high of 65. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That's music from BBC's Pride and Prejudice from 1995. It's from the scene where Darcy and Elizabeth dance and chit-chat. Getting back to the fact that Jane Austen didn't rely on current events to turn the pages, and that she didn't appear interested in things like the Industrial Revolution and other big, the Napoleonic Wars and all that. In my mind, what she was always interested in and continues to be an issue is the status of women.
Yes, yes, very much so. But she couldn't be mistaken for the kind of feminists that were coming to the fore in her day.
Right.
I mean, she was not in the Wollstonecraft mold at all, but her feminism or her pro-womanishness is completely evident. I mean, at every point in her books, because she, highlights, say, in Pride and Prejudice, that, dilemma for all middle-class dependent women, which was whether you were going to marry or not. If you were, you'd have to be dependent on somebody because your class and your gender precluded you from having paid work of an ordinary or satisfying kind. But, you'd go from being under the protection of your father to being married, and your property, of course, didn't belong to you. And Austen has so many marriages, and obviously the plots are all about trying to get married, but you don't try to get married in an Austen novel if you're the heroine because you approve of marriage. It's because you are in love with the amazing hero. I mean, the men that the heroines get are always far better than the usual run of men. And she's extremely worldly about what the usual run of men and women are like. I mean, she doesn't idealize anybody apart from the hero and heroine. I think that's safe to say. And, you get these actually rather appalling glimpses of what life really is like for a lot of women. And you think of Charlotte Lucas. I mean, that's an extraordinary...
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, it's not played in a sort of tragic way. It just is inherently very problematic and borderline tragic, isn't it? I mean, the Charlotte Lucas marriage to Mr. Collins, goodness me.
And yet there was a glimpse in that regarding Charlotte that, well, she seems happy.
Mm.
She acknowledged that. Elizabeth did, that as much as she was horrified by the prospect of that match, well, she seems happy.
She seems happy, except, well, she's happy because she arranges the house,
right,
the rectory, doesn't she, so that she doesn't have to be too near her husband.
Ever.
So again, within her more compromised, circumstances that leave her less choices than, or fewer choices rather than Lizzie has, I mean, you know, temperamentally and in every other way. Charlotte then has to go, you know, keep changing her, you know, just tweaking it so that it doesn't become unbearable. But it does require constant surveillance, you know.
And I always thought about, you know, progeny and things like that, but we won't go there. You know, illustrated versions of the book became very popular. And I was kind of wondering about that and wondered if it's the same reason why the films have been so popular, because we just love to see these characters.
Yes, I think that, I mean, that started in the late 19th century when cheaper printing techniques made it possible to have, you know, lots of illustrations. I mean, earlier on in the 19th century, you'd typically have one or two. You know, you'd have a frontispiece and a vignette or something, but it was just too expensive to do the engraving, and you know, books just weren't super illustrated. But then by the 1890s, when you could get, you know, these different techniques, you'd start to get massively, I think, over-illustrated versions of Jane Austen, because people, again, it was after the memoir of Jane Austen was published, and people had started to get terribly interested in her as an author rather than just the books as books. And suddenly the books just weren't quite enough. You know, there weren't going to be any more novels coming from this pen. Mm-hmm. This is just the six. And people had read them all, and they wanted just to dwell on it. I mean, as we were saying before, these are extremely rereadable books. They're books that you know, you just live with. I mean, you have them in your imagination. They're very comforting. You feel you know the characters. And the early editions that had actual, you know, kind of that would establish what, say, Lizzie Bennet looked like and take it all the way through and put her in all sorts of different situations all the way through the book in illustrations. I mean, those just gave an extra dimension. They kind of fed people's huge burgeoning hunger for images and for daydreaming, really, about the text, which is exactly what the films have done for our, you know, generation.
What do you think of the films? The recent batch since the 90s.
Yeah. Well, that Pride and Prejudice from 1995 clearly was, you know, that kind of kick-started the huge interest in film versions of Austen. But it's odd, isn't it, that you get more and more. I mean, you think that that you know, six-hour Pride and Prejudice would have
how much more? Yeah.
For all time. But in fact, in a way, we can just it makes us want more and more versions of the same book, because you want to see different, you know, actresses playing Lizzie and see if they get it right. It's almost like just tinkering with these things. But I loved that adaptation. It was wonderfully written by Andrew Davis. I mean, the screenplay was very close to the novel.
Very.
And it was also leisurely. I mean, it gave you a lot of time, and it lovely production values, and of course it gave you plenty of time to fall in love with Colin Firth. You know, 6 hours of it, plus the wet shirt scene. You know,
the look he gives her across the room. You know, that
exactly.
Look.
Exactly. Yes, that kind of snooty look. He was very well cast. But I mean, poor Colin Firth. You know, he's been trying to dissociate himself from that role ever since. And I think that film he made, A Single Man, you know, he's just actually trying to deal the death blow to Darcy in that film. He's just really desperately trying to get away from Mr. Darcy. But, you know, the scene, in fact, some people, if you said the words Jane Austen to them, they'd think Colin Firth in a wet shirt. I mean, you know, that's such a powerful icon now. But, of course, that's not a scene that's in the book. And it's actually not even a scene that he didn't do the jumping into the water even. I mean, you know, he had a stunt double do that. It all gets very...
There's nothing real about this.
Nothing real, no, absolutely. It's made up by the screenwriter, and it's not even performed by the actor. And yet it becomes the iconic Jane Austen film scene. It's very interesting.
I guess, you know, that's an important scene, no question about it. And I did go back to the book immediately and say, wait a minute. I don't remember this being in the book. But for me, it was his looks at her, you know, when she's calming his sister at the piano in the movie.
Yes.
And just the looks. And I'm like, oh, my God. No one's ever looked at me like that. It was amazing. You know, Colin Firth has tried to separate himself from this image ever since, and yet he did Bridget Jones's diary.
And, exactly. Yes.
We have a scene from that. We'll play the audio from that right now.
What I'm trying to say, very inarticulately, is perhaps despite appearances, I like you very much.
Apart from the smoking and the drinking and the vulgar mother and the verbal diarrhea.
No, I like you very much, just as you are.
Okay, all right. Now, that of course, is the parallel to the story where he's trying to propose to her. And she rejects him, and it doesn't actually turn out the same way in Bridget Jones's diary. But what did you think of that?
Well, you know, the whole book was very deliberately, mm-hmm. you know, emulating the plot of Pride and Prejudice, and Helen Fielding was terribly witty about that, you know, and she calls her hero Mark Darcy, in case we're in any doubt. And then, of course, you know, they got Colin Firth to play him in the film. So, I mean, there's all... It all kind of just, it's an example of how this stuff feeds on itself, because, you know, people are onto a good thing. You feel the vibe with the Austin, and it flows over into these other spin-offs and things that are connected with it. But yes, I mean, it's also, you know, Helen Fielding said that it was a great plot and the author was dead, so she could feel it. But it is a wonderful plot twist, isn't it, to have, you get, you know, a third or halfway through your novel, and suddenly the thing happens that you think is going to happen at the end. The standoffish hero melts, proposes or whatever, you know, actually it looks as if the heroine's got what she wanted. And then she decides that's not what she wanted. And that really throws the reader or the viewer into a...
Like, oh my gosh.
In the turmoil. Yeah.
What
can happen? And I mean, actually, Austin wasn't the first person to do that. In fact, Fanny Burney did it. At least, you know, she's one of many people who've used that before. But Austin did it so much more cleverly and more comically. I mean, it's just the way that she treats the material is anxious making, but very comical. And Helen Fielding, being another, you know, great comic writer, quite rightly saw that was a wonderful trope to use and picked it up and ran with it.
You know, the movie Clueless was also a take on Emma. And which is the first Austin book I ever read, and I was never going to go see Clueless. I had no, you know, I didn't care about it. It was not the kind of genre I was interested in. I thought until I heard that it was, you know, written in parallel to Emma. Yeah. And then I had to see it.
Yeah.
And then you spend the whole time trying to figure out, you know, who's who.
Yes, yes. It was very, very wittily done. Very, very good kind of riff on Emma, because it doesn't keep, you know, so close. And it's also just, it's very well acted too. I mean, it makes the whole thing over into such a joyfully silly West Coast comedy. It's very clever. And then there's also things like Bride and Prejudice, which is Gurinder Chadha's take on Pride and Prejudice, which shows exactly how relevant that marriage plot, you know, what does the mother do who's got all these girls to marry off? And of course, in our contemporary world, that's a much more pressing issue in, you know, India than it is in England. And that revived the comedy of that situation. I mean, so you had all the other familiar things about Pride and Prejudice then were kind of given a shot in the arm by this, you know, complete relevance of Austin's social message there. And then you get things like the Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, you know, which when that came out last
year, I haven't heard of that.
It's a book by Seth Graham Smith, which is 85% Austin's text of Pride and Prejudice. I mean, it's 85% of Austin. And then 15%, as he says, added ultra-violent zombie mayhem. So basically, he's taken the book and inserted little bits of ninja brides and... I mean, I haven't, you know, the zombie genre is not my favorite, as you might well imagine.
Uh-huh.
And I was asked to look at the book and didn't want it in my house, actually, because I found the cover very upsetting. It had a sort of deteriorating sort of Regency female portrait. It was horrible. So I went to a bookshop and looked at it in the bookshop, and it was well done. But I mean, it certainly wasn't anything I would go towards. But it's been so popular. It sold millions of copies because people who like the zombie genre and people who just like the joke of it. I mean, it's a very transgressive use of Austen, and it's got a lot of potency in that way. And it's been phenomenally successful.
Yeah, I'm looking at the cover right now. Oh, geez. Yes. Okay. We have a couple emails. Let's grab one of those quick before we have to take another break. I don't know whether this person is joshing us or not, but they say it's from Gemma on Facebook. Just finished Claire Harmon's book, amazing review of Austen's Rise, Fall, and Rise Again. Did it surprise Ms. Harmon that the family thought so little of preserving Austen's literary estate? After all, the king and other influential people had been enthusiastic. That's a question I wanted to ask, too. It was surprising.
It seems very surprising to us. It wasn't so unusual for things not to be kept. I mean, it also depends on the temperament of, you know, the people who are involved and who inherit papers. But we've only got 161 letters of Jane Austen that have survived. But in fact, that's not a tiny amount. I mean, it's quite a lot compared with some writers and whose archives are even smaller. What's interesting about the family is not that they didn't value Jane's work, which they did, but it's just that I don't think they thought of it as something that posterity would be interested in. They didn't think of her as a sort of subject for a biography, you know, until the 1870s, and they didn't think of her as having a sort of relevance beyond her own generation. You know, they were very proud of her at the time, but they just didn't see her as an author who'd be read in, say, 50 years after her death. I mean, it just wouldn't have occurred to them. And that's it makes them seem a bit chilly and strange to us. But I think if you just, you know, put yourself back into that kind of household, very close, very self-contained sort of family. Mm-hmm. And of course, Jane wasn't married, and her only sister also wasn't married. So, you know, they had loads of nephews and nieces, but they weren't, it was a kind of widespread family with, you know, many ties of affection, but there wasn't a sort of bloodline going right easily away from Jane Austen. I think you can see it as a kind of flare up within one generation, and then they expected it to flare down. Obviously it's absolutely tantalizing when you think that how many other letters she must have written during her lifetime. And, you know, did she leave other manuscripts that were destroyed? Mm-hmm. Did she keep a diary? I mean, it's hard to think how somebody whose dialogue in the novels is so accurate sounding and whose recall of how people behave is so impressive. It's hard to think that she didn't keep a lot of notes somehow. Yes, I mean, all that, you know, none of that survives. And the manuscripts of the novels don't survive. It's only the fragments of the unfinished novels and some pieces of juvenilia. But the actual text that she sent to the printers were thrown away by the printer, one assumes, or thrown away by the author herself or her family later on. Very frustrating.
We have to take a quick break. My guest is Claire Harmon, author of Jane's Fame, How Jane Austen Conquered the World. If you'd like to speak with Claire, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. That last message from Gemma came via Facebook. You can go to our Facebook page at All Sides with Ann Fisher's Facebook page as well. We'll be right back with All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
After being held in North Korea for 5 months, journalist Laura Ling was finally offered a way to avoid a sentence of 12 years hard labor. Find the right envoy.
The official said to me, "President Clinton is your best and last option. And when he said that, I knew what had to be done.
On the next Fresh Air, Laura and Lisa Ling on their book, Somewhere Inside. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Get the latest information from our station the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Just go to wosu.org/email and sign up for one of WOSU's e-newsletters.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
58 degrees in downtown Columbus. Slight chance of rain throughout the day today, otherwise cloudy skies and a high of 65. Clear skies tonight, a low of 48 degrees, and looks like a nice day for tomorrow. Sunshine and a high of 78 for Thursday. Looking ahead to Friday, clouds and a high of 77. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Once again, that's music from BBC's Pride and Prejudice from 1995, and it's the scene where Darcy and Elizabeth dance and try to avoid each other. Strange, counterintuitive relationship made famous by Jane Austen. That's what we're talking about right now with Claire Harmon. She's a biographer of Jane. Her book is Jane's Fame, How Jane Austen Conquered the World. Jane was not reclusive, though. She wasn't, but she was did prefer her anonymity, right?
Yes. She had a little taste of fame during her lifetime. You know, as I was saying, her first book was published in 1811, and she had, a significant readership, but she didn't really get to hear much about who was reading her books. We know about it because some of these readers were writing letters to each other or, you know, writing journals. And Austen did get wind of some of the reception of her books, but not much. But what she understood about her fame was really mostly local. Eventually, as some of the neighbours got to realise that she was the author of books that they'd been reading, because the books were published anonymously, so, you know, Sense mm-hmm. and Sensibility just said it was by a lady. And it was in the local circulating library, and also Jane Austen was in a book club. I mean, there was a Jane Austen book club in in Chawton, in the village in Hampshire where she lived. They had a reading society, which was a way in which you could read books without... I mean, books were very expensive, and it was a way of being able to circulate books locally. And so you keep each... You'd have a pick yourself, and then you'd keep it for a fortnight and pass it around. And some of the people in her local reading society, you know, got to know that she had published a novel. And people started to behave rather strangely around her, you know. Mm-hmm. They'd also say odd things about her books, and Austen recorded... for two of her books, for Mansfield Park and for Emma, she recorded the opinions that people had voiced to her, and some of them are just hilariously drab. You know, sort of her sister-in-law would say, you know, she thought the book was all right, or, you know, but it wasn't that good, or, you know, somebody would say that Mansfield Park wasn't as good as Pride and Prejudice, but it was just about tolerable, and one the local lady said that. If she hadn't known who the author was, she would have hardly been able to push herself through it. This was talking about Emma, for goodness sake. You know, and obviously Austen recorded these things. It's just on a couple of pieces of paper uh-huh. because they were so hilariously revealing of the people who said them. I mean, uh-huh. Austen was a profoundly cynical person, I think, and wouldn't have wished to solicit opinions that, you know, that might have been hurtful, and she could cope, and she could get a lot of fun out of that, the ones that she heard, and some of them were genuinely praising, and she loved that too. But she wasn't going to put herself in the way of being attended to in that way. And there's a really revealing and strange anecdote about a mutual friend of Austen and Mary Russell Mitford, who was another novelist, who was born in Hampshire. saying that the mutual friend had been to tea at the Austins, and Jane Austen just hadn't said a thing all the way through. She was absolutely silent. You know, the group of the Austins and the visitors, and Jane Austen just sat there and didn't say a thing the whole time. This was after she was known as a novelist. And the visitor said later to Miss Mitford that, you know, Miss Austen used to just sit and be disregarded like a poker by the fireplace, but now she was a poker of whom everybody is afraid. You know, because once these observers knew that Miss Austen was actually likely to observe them and then put them into one of her books as a booby, you know, it made them very nervous. So I presume she made them feel disconcerted and then just watched them. So it's a very sort of a very strange way of dealing with celebrity, isn't it?
Yes.
To sort of hold people at bay and to and not to be kind of particularly pleased by it.
You know, I just watched the movie Becoming Jane last night. It's kind of fresh in my mind, and I was wondering what you thought about that, and what about Tom Lefroy, the love interest in that movie? It's a fictionalization of her life. And you mention him very briefly. His name pops up briefly in your book.
Yes. Well, the real Tom Lefroy is a very interesting character. And he and Jane Austen clearly did flirt, I think very briefly, in the 1790s. It's hard to tell whether he flirted with her or whether she was just sort of camping it up a bit in order to have something to, you know, to write about to her sister and to kind of just another running joke. She had a lot of these jokes with her sister in letters. And because Tom Lefroy himself, I have it from one of his direct descendants, who's my daughter's godmother, actually, Helen Lefroy, says that he was a very pious young man, and his papers, which have been preserved, they're all in an archive in Kent, show him to be not at all the kind of sexy, you know, Jack the Lad character as portrayed in the film. I mean, very charmingly by James McAvoy, the actor.
Very charmingly.
You know, he kind of dashes around looking up for anything, really.
Right.
But then the real Tom Lefroy was actually a much more sedate and probably if Jane Austen was flirting with him, he might have been scared off. Certainly, they weren't. It wasn't approved of as a match, but it probably didn't get as far as needing approval. I think it was a very fleeting flirtation. There were other young men that Jane Austen flirted with, but they don't get flagged up in the letters quite so obviously. And to choose, I mean, clearly the filmmakers wanted to kind of get a symbolic, you know, romance going, and it is a fiction, but it's a fiction that deviates, I think, fairly significantly from the known facts of Austen's life, and having the gorgeous Anne Hathaway there was also a bit, I mean, but it's Hollywood, for goodness sakes.
They've done worse things, that's for sure.
Yes.
I wanted to do a cut from that and then talk about, you know, curious about what they're getting at here. Let's listen to this.
Propriety commands me to ignorance.
Condemns you to it. And your writing to the status of female accomplishment. If you wish to practice the art of fiction, to be the equal of a masculine author, experience is vital.
I guess, you know, what I was wondering is people are always trying to figure out, how did she know so much about relationships if she never married, if she never was in a formally deep relationship with anyone that anyone knows of? How did she know so much?
She was intelligent and imaginative, and there was plenty going on around her. You know, you don't have to be married to... sometimes if you're married, you know less about marriage than the people who observe it. And, you know, Austen... she did almost marry, you know, herself in 1802. She was proposed to by a man called, wonderful name, Harris Big Wither, and he was the heir to a very nice estate in Hampshire, and he was the younger brother of two of her dearest friends. So that was a very attractive proposal from all sorts of point of view, and she accepted him. I mean, you know, this is known, although the documentation for that year in terms of letters, doesn't exist anymore. But she did accept him, and then the next morning decided that was not a good idea. And, you know, she may have had other proposals, she may have accepted other men, who knows. But she certainly was thinking that she might marry in 1802, mm-hmm. And didn't. And obviously she would have probably had children if she'd got married to Harris Bigwither. She may well have died in childbirth, you know, in 1803 or 1804. And not marrying enabled her to write her books and to keep on observing. And I think the lack of distraction from not being married just made her much more clear-sighted, too. I mean, she was able to, you know, keep this kind of judgmental distance on other people's behavior. And it does make it very... a very sort of thoroughgoing view of human nature. But also, I mean, there is one thing in her novel. She doesn't show men together. It's been observed by many critics that she's pretty good at men, but she's not. She doesn't really know what they talk about when mm-hmm. they're on their own. So she doesn't pretend that she might know. She keeps them in rooms with women. And so she doesn't kind of she doesn't push her luck with what she's describing, and keeps it just about within the terms of, you know, the bounds of the probable. Well, some male critics have found her men a little bit feeble, a bit too girly.
Her relationship in Sense and Sensibility between Eleanor and Marianne. Reminded me a lot of her relationship with her sister, people suppose that that's what it was inspired by. And let's listen to this scene real quick.
Always resignation and acceptance. Always prudence and honor and duty. Eleanor, where is your heart? What do you know of my heart? What do you know of anything but your own suffering? For weeks, Marianne, I've had this pressing on me, without being at liberty to speak of it to a single creature. I have endured her exaltation again and again, whilst knowing myself to be divided from Edward forever. Believe me, Marianne, had I not been bound to silence, I could have produced proof enough of a broken heart, even for you.
Just listening to that again. Mm. That was Kate Winslet and Emma Thompson as Eleanor. What about her relationships between women?
I think they're brilliant. I think she's, especially that sibling relationship, mm-hmm. which she, you know, was incredibly important to her. Eleanor is, if you're looking for biographical parallels anyway, is very probably based on Cassandra. And that's what makes that novel so extraordinary, because that would, throw, you know, make Jane the Marianne Dashwood mm-hmm. character there, who's really less sensitive and less... perceptive, and, you know, Eleanor's the one who has to suffer in silence and sacrifice all sorts of things. And so it's a kind of tribute to her elder sister's extremely long-suffering behavior over her bereavement and obstacles to her own, into Cassandra's own happiness. So it's a sort of sibling tribute, really, in many ways. But I think, especially with sisters, it often has that peculiar sort of strength of feeling there. And then, of course, there are so many girlfriends in Austen novels that don't quite come up to the sibling standard. You know, mm-hmm. These girls who appear to be very sweet and charming, but then always have a you know, sort of loyalty problem or a, mm-hmm. a selfishness problem. And that's very, very well observed too, isn't it? Especially with young women, you know, you get these strong, fiercely strong ties. But then, when they're tested, all sorts of things can go wrong. I mean, when you think of Isabella Thorpe, and even in Pride and Prejudice, even somebody like Charlotte Lucas, who appears to be Lizzie's closest friend.
Right.
You know, then kind of goes out of her orbit really almost immediately and becomes almost like a stranger. I mean, her behavior right. becomes incomprehensible or hard to connect with.
Right.
So really, the family is the unit that yeah. the novels keep coming back to.
We have an email from Dolly. She writes, many of Austen's plots involve adult themes, seductions, illicit elopements. In other words, Willoughby, Wickham, etc. Was it seen, Willoughby, was it seen as scandalous or controversial that a spinster wrote such plots? Of course, in the case of Willoughby and Wickham, they both impregnated defenseless women.
Yes. It wasn't thought to be particularly scandalous because a lot of novels dealt with many more, you know, kind of appalling situations than that, or actually made them quite explicit. If you think of Samuel Richardson, even, you know, with all the rapes and abductions in his novels, and he was, because his point of view was always very moralistic, he was thought to be, you know, one of the most upright of writers. But I mean, he got through an awful lot of sex and mayhem before he got to the moral. Austen doesn't really show any of that explicitly. She refers to a lot of, as your reader has said, a lot of action like that in the background. Is part of the inevitable texture of the books because they are realistic. But Austen, of course, because she published anonymously, she didn't have to take any flack personally for that. But novel writing was thought, I mean, not so much by her, but by some contemporaries, to be an inherently scandalous thing to be either doing or reading. You know, actually, genteel ladies weren't expected to be novelists, and that's, you know, they did. That's part of the reason why they published anonymously. And some people were very snobby about reading novels, and the Austen family weren't at all. They, you know, they weren't priggish, they weren't prudish. They were very, you know, sort of conventional and moral Church of England members. they weren't loose in any sense at all. But they were, they, neither were they prigs, and they enjoyed novels. But it was still a kind of borderline area in Austen's day. You know, whether it was whether you should be seen reading novels rather than works of history or encyclopedias or reference works.
We just have about a minute left now. But I was wondering if you have a favorite of her novels, or do you, like I, read them in a mood basis? You know, what am I in the mood for?
Yeah, it's a mood basis, really. And also, it's as I was saying before, it's kind of age-related, too. Mm-hmm. And I must say, I do love Persuasion.
So do I. That's my skill. I love that. That is amazing.
It's the autumn years kind of book,
maybe, you know, give away my age, I suppose. But I love, that's my favorite, too.
It's so poignant. But then Northanger Abbey, which is one that I've reread least times, it has got so many great jokes in. I mean, I also like that just for a kind of a knockabout comedy and odd. But no, I think Anne Elliot is just the most heartbreaking heroine.
Yes. And it ends in it's a happy ending, though. Claire
yeah.
Harmon, thanks so much for joining us today. I really enjoyed our conversation.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Claire Harmon, author of Jane's Fame, How Jane Austen Conquered the World. Thanks for joining us on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the law firm Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, offering legal services to Central Ohio since 1936. Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, big enough to win, small enough to care. On the web at isaacbrandt.com.